This is Audible.
This is a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Hi, you may not know me, but I am Sean's dad, Stephen Covey. Sean is especially qualified to write this book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective Teens, because he and his brothers and sisters were the guinea pigs. I used to test my hypotheses, and from those experiences and stupid mistakes, I wrote a book called The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. This book has sold many millions all over the world and has been translated into 34 languages. The 7 Habits are a framework of thinking and of doing. And as good as some may think my book is, Sean's book is a lot better and a lot more fun. In fact, someone wrote on the internet, Sean's father ought to learn a thing or two about writing. You'll find this book to be full of real-life stories from real-life kids who have applied or not applied the 7 habits to their lives, and you'll see the results in their stories. This book also includes fun quotes, poetry, quizzes, and baby steps. You'll be given opportunity to reflect and to put these principles into practice. I know I may be biased, but I want you to know that this is the very best teen, young adult book ever written, at least that I have ever read. It has already sold over 3 million copies.
Welcome. My name is Sean, and I wrote this book. I don't know how you got this book. Maybe your mom gave it to you to shape you up, or maybe you bought it with your own money because the title caught your eye. Well, regardless of how it landed in your hands, I'm really glad it did. Now you just need to read it. A lot of teens read books, but I wasn't one of them. I did read several Cliff Notes book summaries, however. So if you're like me, you may be ready to shelf this book. But before you do that, hear me out. If you promise to read this book, I'll promise to make it an adventure. In fact, to keep it fun, I've stuffed it full of cartoons, clever ideas, great quotes, and incredible stories about real teens from all over the world, along with a few other surprises. So, will you give it a try? Okay? Okay. Part 1, The Setup. Get in the habit. They make you or break you. Who am I? I am your constant companion. I am your greatest helper or heaviest burden. I will push you onward or drag you down to failure. I am completely at your command. Half the things you do, you might just as well turn over to me, and I will be able to do them quickly and correctly. I am easily managed. You must merely be firm with me. Show me exactly how you want something done, and after a few lessons, I will do it automatically. I am the servant of all great individuals, and alas, of all failures as well. Those who are great, I have made great. Those who are failures, I have made failures. I am not a machine, though I work with all the precision of a machine, plus the intelligence of a human. You may run me for a profit or run me for ruin. It makes no difference to me. Take me, train me, be firm with me, and I will place the world at your feet. Be easy with me, and I will destroy you. Who am I? I am habit. This book is based on another book that my dad, Stephen R. Covey, wrote several years ago entitled The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Surprisingly, that book has become one of the best-selling books of all time. He owes a lot of the credit for its success to me and my brothers and sisters, however. You see, we were his guinea pigs. He tried out all of his psycho experiments on us, and that's why my brothers and sisters have major emotional problems. Just kidding, siblings. Luckily, I escaped uninjured. So, why did I write this book? I wrote it because life for teens is no longer a playground. It's a jungle out there. And if I've done my job right, this book can be like a compass to help you navigate through it. In addition, unlike my dad's book, which was written for old people, and to be honest, it can be really boring at times, this book was written especially for teens and is always interesting. Although I'm a retired teenager, I remember what it was like to be one. I could have sworn I was riding an emotional roller coaster most of the time. Looking back, I'm actually amazed that I survived. Barely. I'll never forget the time in 7th grade when I first fell in love with a girl named Nicole. I told my friend Claire to tell her that I liked her. I was too scared to speak directly to girls, so I used interpreters instead. Well, Claire completed his mission and returned and reported. "Hey, Sean, I told Nicole that you liked her." "What'd she say?" I giggled. She said, "Ooh, Sean, he's fat." Claire laughed. I was devastated. I felt like crawling into a hole and never coming out again. I vowed to hate girls for life. Luckily, my hormones prevailed and I began liking girls again. But I suspect that some of the struggles that teens have shared with me are also familiar to you.
"There's too much to do and not enough time. I've got school, homework, job, friends, parties, and family on top of everything else. I'm totally stressed out. Help!
How can I feel good about myself when I don't match up? Everywhere I look, I am reminded that someone else is smarter or prettier or more popular. I can't help but think, if I only had her hair, her clothes, her personality, her boyfriend, then I'd be happy.
I feel as if my life is out of control.
My family is a disaster. If I could only get my parents off my back, I might be able to live my life. It seems they're constantly nagging, and I can't ever seem to satisfy them.
I know I'm not living the way I should. I'm into everything. Drugs, drinking, sex, you name it. When I'm with my friends, I give in and just do what everyone else is doing.
I started yet another diet. I think it's my 5th one this year. I do want to change, but I just don't have the discipline to stick with it. Each time I start a new diet, I have hope, but it's usually only a short time before I blow it, and then I feel awful.
I'm not doing too well in school right now. If I don't get my grades up, I'll never go to college.
I'm moody and I get depressed often, and I don't know what to do about it.
These problems are real, and you can't turn off real life, so I won't try. Instead, I'll give you a set of tools to help you deal with real life. What are they? I call them the 7 Habits of Highly Effective Teens, or said another way, the 7 characteristics that happy and successful teens the world over have in common. By now, you're probably wondering what these habits are, so I might as well just end the suspense. Here they are, followed by a brief explanation. Habit 1. Be proactive. This means take responsibility for your life. Habit 2. Begin with the end in mind. Define your mission and goals in life. Habit 3. Put first things first. This basically means prioritize and do the most important things first. Habit 4. Think win-win. Have an everyone-can-win attitude. Habit 5. Seek first to understand, then to be understood. This basically means listen to people sincerely. Habit 6. Synergize. Work together to achieve more. And Habit 7. Sharpen the saw. Renew yourself regularly. The habits build upon each other. Habits 1, 2, and 3 deal with self-mastery. We call it the private victory. Habits 4, 5, and 6 deal with relationships and teamwork. We call that the public victory. You've got to get your personal act together before you can be a good team player. That's why the private victory always comes before the public victory. The last habit, Habit 7, is the habit of renewal. It feeds all of the other 6 habits. The habits seem rather simple, don't they? But just wait till you see how powerful they can be. One great way to understand what the 7 habits are is to understand what they are not. So here are the opposites, or what I call the 7 habits of highly defective teens. Habit 1, react. Blame all your problems on your parents, your stupid teachers or professors, your lousy neighborhood, your boyfriend or girlfriend, the government, or something or somebody else. Be a victim. Take no responsibility for your life at all. Act like an animal. If you're hungry, eat. If someone yells at you, yell back. If you feel like doing something you know is wrong, just do it. Habit 2. Begin with no end in mind. Don't have a plan, avoid goals at all costs, and never think about tomorrow. Why worry about the consequences of your actions? Live for the moment. Sleep around, get wasted, and party on, dude, for tomorrow we die. Habit 3. Put first things last. Whatever is most important in your life, don't do it until you have spent sufficient time watching reruns, talking endlessly on the phone, surfing the net, and lounging around. Always put off your homework until tomorrow. Make sure that things that don't matter always come before things that do. Habit 4. Think, win, lose. See life as a vicious competition. Your classmate is out to get you, so you'd better get him or her first. Don't let anyone else succeed at anything because remember, if they win, you lose. If it looks like you're going to lose, however, make sure you drag that sucker down with you. Habit 5. Seek first to talk, then pretend to listen. You were born with a mouth, so use it. Make sure you talk a lot. Always express your side of the story first. Once you're sure everyone understands your views, then pretend to listen by nodding and saying, uh-huh. Or, if you really want their opinion, give it to them. Habit 6. Don't cooperate. Let's face it, other people are weird because they're different from you. So why try to get along with them? Teamwork is for the dogs. Since you always have the best ideas, you are better off doing everything by yourself. Be your own island. Habit 7. Wear yourself out. Be so busy with life that you never take time to renew or improve yourself. Never study, don't learn anything new, avoid exercise like the plague, and for heaven's sake, stay away from good books, nature, or anything else that may inspire you. As you can see, the habits listed above are recipes for disaster, yet many of us indulge in them regularly, me included. And given this, it's no wonder that life can really stink at times. So, just what exactly are habits? Well, habits are things we do repeatedly, but most of the time we are hardly aware that we even have them. They're on autopilot. Some habits are good, such as exercising regularly, planning ahead, showing respect for other people. Some habits are bad, like thinking negatively, feeling inferior, or blaming other people. And some habits, well, they just don't really matter, including things like taking showers at night instead of the morning, or eating yogurt with a fork, or reading magazines from the back to the front. Depending on what they are, our habits will either make us or break us. We become what we repeatedly do. As writer Samuel Smiles put it, sow a thought and you reap an act. Sow an act and you reap a habit. Sow a habit and you reap a character. Sow a character and you reap a destiny. Luckily, you are stronger than your habits. Therefore, you can change them. For example, try folding your arms. Now, try folding them in the opposite way. How does this feel? Pretty strange, doesn't it? But you know what? If you folded them in the opposite way for about 30 days in a row, it wouldn't feel so strange. You wouldn't even have to think about it. You'd get in the habit. At any time, you can look yourself in the mirror and say, hey, I don't like that about myself. And you can exchange a bad habit for a better one. It's not always easy, but it's always possible. Not every idea in this book will work for you, but you don't have to be perfect to see results either. Just living some of the habits some of the time can help you experience changes in your life you never thought possible. The 7 habits can help you get control of your life, improve your relationships with your friends, make smarter decisions, get along with your parents, overcome addiction, define your values and what matters most to you, get more done in less time, increase your self-confidence, be happy, and find balance between school, work, friends, and everything else you've got on your plate. One final point. This is your book, so use it. Listen to the stories that inspire you. Memorize the quotes that give you hope. At the end of each chapter are baby steps, which were designed to help you start living the habits immediately. You'll get a lot more done if you give these a try. If you're the kind of reader who likes to skip around, looking for cartoons and other interesting tidbits, that's just fine. But at some point, you ought to read the book from start to finish because the 7 habits are sequential. They all build on each other. Habit 1 comes before habit 2 and so on for a reason. So, what do you say? Make my day and listen to this CD. Coming attractions. Up next, we'll take a look at 10 of the dumbest statements ever made. You don't want to miss them, so listen on. Paradigms and principles. What you see is what you get. The following is a list of statements made many years ago by experts in their fields. At the time they were said, they sounded intelligent. With the passing of time, they sound idiotic. I call them top 10 all-time stupid quotes. Number 10, said by Kenneth Olson, who was the president and founder of Digital Equipment Corporation in 1977. Here's what he said. There is no reason for any individual to have a computer in their home. Number 9, said by Marshal Ferdinand Foch, French military strategist and future World War I commander in 1911. Quote, "Airplanes are interesting toys, but of no military value." Number 8. Dr. Lee DeForest, inventor of the Audion tube and father of radio, said on February 25, 1967, "Man will never reach the moon, regardless of all future scientific advances." Number 7. Said by Daryl F. Zanuck, head of 20th Century Fox in 1946. "Television won't be able to hold on to any market it captures after the first 6 months. People will soon get tired of staring at a plywood box every night." Number 6. Decca Records rejecting the Beatles in a letter in 1962. Here's what they said. "We don't like their sound. Groups of guitars are on the way out." Number 5. Dr. Ian G. MacDonald, Los Angeles surgeon, as quoted in Newsweek, November 18, 1969. Quote, "For the majority of people, the use of tobacco has a beneficial effect." Number 4. A Western Union internal memo in 1876 said, "This telephone has too many shortcomings to be seriously considered as a means of communication. The device is inherently of no value to us." Number 3. Ptolemy, the great Egyptian astronomer in the 2nd century, said this, "The Earth is the center of the universe." Number 2. Written by King George III of England on July 4th, 1776. "Nothing of importance happened today." And number 1. Most stupid quote ever said in the history of the intergalactic empire. Charles H. Duell, U.S. Commissioner of Patents in 1899. "Everything that can be invented has been invented." Having read these, let me share with you another list of statements made by real teens just like you. You've heard them all before, and they're just as ridiculous as the ones I just read. "No one in my family has ever gone to college. I'd be crazy to think I could make it." "It's no use. My stepdad and I will never get along. We're just too different." "Being smart is a white thing." "My teacher's out to get me." "She's so pretty, I'll bet she's a jerk." "You can't get ahead in life unless you know the right people. Come on." "Me, thin? Are you kidding? My whole family is full of fat people." "It's impossible to get a good job around here because nobody wants to hire a teen." So, what's a paradigm? What do these statements I just read have in common? Well, first, they're all perceptions about the way things are. Second, they're all inaccurate or incomplete, even though the people who said them are convinced they're true. Another word for perceptions is paradigms. A paradigm is the way you see something. It's your point of view, your frame of reference or belief. As you may have noticed, our paradigms are often way off the mark, and as a result, they create limitations. For instance, you may be convinced that you don't have what it takes to get into college, but remember Ptolemy was just as convinced that the Earth was the center of the universe. And think about the teen who believes she can't get along with her stepdad. If that is her paradigm, is she likely to ever get along? Probably not, because that belief will hold her back. Paradigms are like a pair of glasses. When you have incomplete paradigms about yourself or life in general, it's like wearing glasses with the wrong prescription. That lens affects how you see everything else. As a result, what you see is what you get. If you believe you're dumb, that very belief will make you dumb. If you believe your sister is dumb, you'll look for evidence to support your belief, find it, and she'll remain dumb in your eyes. On the other hand, if you believe you're smart, that belief will cast a rosy hue on everything you do. A teen named Christy once shared with me how much she loved the beauty of the mountains. One day she went to visit her eye doctor and, to her surprise, discovered that her sight was much worse than she had thought. After putting in her new contacts, she was astonished at how well she could see. As she put it, "I realized that the mountains and the trees and even the signs on the side of the road have more detail than I had ever imagined. It was the strangest thing. I don't know how bad my eyes were until I experienced how good they could be." That's often the way it is. We don't know how much we're missing because we have messed up paradigms. We have paradigms about ourselves, about other people, and about life in general. Let's take a look at each. Paradigms of self. Stop right now and consider this question. Are your paradigms of yourself helping or hindering you? When my wife Rebecca was a junior at Madison High School in Idaho, a sign-up sheet for the Miss Madison pageant was passed around in class. Rebecca, along with many other girls, signed up. Linda, who sat next to Rebecca, passed without signing. "Sign up, Linda," insisted Rebecca. "Oh, no, I couldn't do that. Come on, it'll be fun." "No, really, I'm not the type." "Sure you are. I think you'd do great," chimed Rebecca. Rebecca and others continued to encourage Linda until she finally signed. Rebecca didn't think anything of the situation at the time. However, 7 years later, she received a letter from Linda describing the inner struggle she had gone through that day and thanking Rebecca for being the spark that helped change her life. Linda related how she suffered from a poor self-image in high school and was just shocked that Rebecca would consider her a candidate for a talent pageant. She had finally agreed to sign up just to get Rebecca and the others off her back. Linda said she was so uncomfortable about being in the pageant that she contacted the pageant director the following day and demanded her name be removed from the list. But, like Rebecca, the director insisted that Linda participate. Reluctantly, Linda agreed. But that was all it took. By daring to participate in an event that demanded the best of her, Linda began to see herself in a new light. In her letter, Linda thanked Rebecca from deep within for, in essence, taking off her warped glasses, shattering them against the floor, and insisting she try on a new pair. Linda noted that although she hadn't won a single title or award, she had overcome an even bigger obstacle, her low perception of herself. Because of her example, her two younger sisters participated in the pageant in later years. It became a big thing in her family. The following year, Linda became a student body officer and, as Rebecca relates, developed a vivacious and outgoing personality. Linda experienced what is called a paradigm shift. It means that you suddenly see things in a new way, as if you just tried on a new pair of glasses. Just as negative self-paradigms can put limitations on us, positive self-paradigms can bring out the best in us, as the following story about the son of King Louis XVI of France illustrates.
King Louis had been taken from his throne and imprisoned. His young son, the prince, was taken by those who dethroned the king. They thought that inasmuch as the king's son was heir to the throne, if they could destroy him morally, he would never realize the great and grand destiny that life had bestowed upon him. They took him to a community far away, and there they exposed the lad to every filthy and vile thing that life could offer. They exposed him to foods, the richness of which would quickly make him a slave to appetite. They used vile language around him constantly. They exposed him to lewd and lusting women. They exposed him to dishonor and distrust. He was surrounded 24 hours a day by everything that could drag the soul of a man as low as one could slip. For over 6 months he had this treatment, but not once did the young lad buckle under pressure. Finally, after intensive temptation, they questioned him. Why had he not submitted himself to these things? Why had he not partaken? These things would provide pleasure, satisfy his lusts, and were desirable. They were all his. The boy said, "I cannot do what you ask, for I was born to be a king."
Prince Louis held that paradigm of himself so tightly that nothing could shake him. In like manner, if you walk through life wearing glasses that say, "I can do it," or "I matter," that belief will put a positive spin on everything else. At this point, you may be wondering, well, if my paradigm of myself is all contorted, then what can I do to fix it? Well, one way is to spend time with somebody who believes in you and builds you up. My mother was such a person to me. When I was growing up, my mom always believed in me, especially when I doubted myself. She was always saying stuff like, "Sean, of course you should run for class president," and, "Of course, Sean, ask her out. I'm sure she would just die to go out with you." It seemed that whenever I needed to be affirmed, I'd talk to my mom and she'd clean my glasses. Ask any successful person, and most will tell you that they had a person who believed in them, a teacher, a friend, a parent, a guardian, a sister, a grandmother. It only takes one person, and it doesn't really matter who it is. Don't be afraid to lean on this person and to get nourished by them. Go to them for advice. Try to see yourself the way they see you. Oh, what a difference a new pair of glasses can make. As someone once said, if you could envision the type of person that God intended you to be, you would rise up and never be the same again. At times, you may not have anyone to lean on and may need to go solo. If this is the case with you, pay special attention to the next chapter, which will give you some handy tools to help you build your self-image. Paradigms of others. We have paradigms not only about ourselves, but also about other people, and they can be way out of whack too. Seeing things from a different point of view can help us understand why other people act the way they do. Becky told me about her paradigm shift.
As a junior in high school, I had a friend named Kim. She was essentially a nice person, but as the year progressed, it became more and more difficult to get along with her. She was easily offended and often felt left out. She was moody and difficult to be around. It got to the point where my friends and I started calling her less and less. Eventually, we stopped inviting her to things. I was gone for a good part of the summer after that year, and when I returned, I was talking to a good friend of mine, catching up on all the news. She was telling me about all the gossip, the different romances, who was dating who, and so on, when suddenly she said, "Oh, did I tell you about Kim? She's been having a hard time lately because her parents are going through a really messy divorce. She's taking it really hard." When I heard this, my whole perspective changed. Rather than being annoyed by Kim's behavior, I felt terrible about my own. I felt I had deserted her in her time of need. Just by knowing that one little bit of information, my whole attitude toward her changed. It was really an eye-opening experience.
And to think that all it took to change Becky's paradigm was a smidgen of new information. We too often judge people without having all the facts, don't we? Monica had a similar experience.
I used to live in California, where I had a lot of good friends. I didn't care about anyone new because I already had my friends, and I thought that new people should deal with it in their own way. Then when I moved in, I was the new kid and wished that someone would care about me and make me part of their group of friends. I see things in a very different way now. I know what it feels like not to have any friends.
From now on, Monica will treat new kids on the block very differently, don't you think? Seeing things from another point of view can make such a difference in our attitude toward others. The following anecdote from Reader's Digest, contributed by Dan P. Grayling, is a classic example of a paradigm shift.
A friend of mine returning to South Africa from a long stay in Europe found herself with some time to spare at London's Heathrow Airport. Buying a cup of coffee and a small package of cookies, she staggered, laden with luggage, to an unoccupied table. She was reading the morning paper when she became aware of someone rustling at her table. From behind her paper, she was flabbergasted to see a neatly dressed young man helping himself to her cookies. She did not want to make a scene, so she leaned across and took a cookie herself. A minute or so passed, more rustling. He was helping himself to another cookie. By the time they were down to the last cookie in the package, she was very angry, but still could not bring herself to say anything. Then the young man broke the cookie in two, pushed half across to her, ate the other half, and left. Sometime later, when the public address system called for her to present her ticket, she was still fuming. Imagine her embarrassment when she opened her handbag and was confronted by her package of cookies. She had been eating his.
Consider this lady's feelings toward the neatly dressed young man before the turn of events. What a rude, presumptive young man. Imagine her feelings afterwards. How embarrassing. How kind of him to share his last cookie with me. So, what's the point? It's simply this. Our paradigms are often incomplete, inaccurate, or completely messed up. Therefore, we shouldn't be so quick to judge, label, or form rigid opinions of other people, or ourselves for that matter. From our limited points of view, we seldom see the whole picture or have all the facts. In addition, we should open our minds and hearts to new information, new ideas and points of view, and be willing to change our paradigms when it comes clear that they're wrong. Most important, it is obvious that if we want to make big changes in our lives, the key is to change our paradigms, or the glasses through which we see the world. Change the lens and everything else follows. If you look closely, you'll find that most of your problems with relationships or self-image or attitude are the result of a messed up paradigm or two. For instance, if you have a poor relationship with, say, your dad, it's likely that both of you have a warped paradigm of each other. You may see him as being totally out of touch with the modern world, and he may see you as a spoiled, ungrateful brat. In reality, both of your paradigms are probably incomplete and are holding you back from real communication. As you'll see, this book will challenge many of your paradigms, and hopefully will help you create more accurate and complete ones. So, get ready. Paradigms of Life. Besides having paradigms about ourselves and others, we also have paradigms about the world in general. You can usually tell what your paradigm is by asking yourself, what is the driving force of my life? What do I spend my time thinking about? Or, who or what is my obsession? Whatever is most important to you will become your paradigm, your glasses, or as I like to call it, your life center. Some of the more popular life centers for teens include things like friends, stuff, boyfriend or a girlfriend, school, parents, sports, hobbies, heroes, enemies, self, and work. They each have their good points, but they are all incomplete in one way or another. And as I'm about to show you, they'll mess you up if you center your life on them. Luckily, there is one center that you can't always count on. We'll save it for last. Friend-centered. There's nothing better than belonging to a great group of friends and nothing worse than feeling like an outcast. Friends are important but should never become your center. Why? Well, occasionally they're fickle. Now and then they're fake. Sometimes they'll talk behind your back or develop new friendships and forget yours. They have mood swings. They move. In addition, if you base your identity on having friends, being accepted, and being popular, you may find yourself compromising your standards or changing them every weekend to accommodate your friends. Believe it or not, the day will come when friends will not be the biggest thing in your life. During high school, I had a fabulous group of friends. We did everything together. We swam in illegal canals. We gorged at all-you-can-eat buffets. We water skied in the night, in the dark. We dated each other's girlfriends. You name it. I love these guys. I felt that we'd be friends forever. After graduating from high school and moving away, however, I've been amazed at how seldom we see each other. I still love these guys, but we live far apart, and new relationships and jobs and family, they take up our time. As a teen, I never could have fathomed this. Make as many friends as you can, but don't build your life on them. It's an unstable foundation. Stuff-centered. Sometimes we see the world through the lens of possessions, or what I call stuff. We live in a material world, and that teaches us that he who dies with the most toys wins. We have to have the fastest car, the nicest clothes, the latest stereo, the best hairstyle, and the many other things that are supposed to bring us happiness. Possessions also come in the form of titles and accomplishments, such as head cheerleader or lead in the play, valedictorian, student body officer, chief editor, or MVP. There is nothing wrong with accomplishing and enjoying our stuff, but we should never center our lives on things, which in the end have no lasting value. Our confidence needs to come from within, not from without. From the quality of our hearts, not the quantity of things we own. After all, he who dies with the most toys still dies. I once knew a girl who had the most beautiful and expensive wardrobe I'd ever seen. She seldom wore the same outfit twice. After getting to know her better, I began to notice that she got much of her self-confidence from her clothes and had a bad case of elevator eyes. It seemed that whenever she talked with another girl, she'd eye her from head to foot to see if her outfit was as nice as her own, which usually gave her a superiority complex. She was stuff-centered, which was a real turnoff to me. I read a saying once that says it better than I can. If who I am is what I have, and what I have is lost, then who am I? Boyfriend, girlfriend-centered. This may be the easiest trap of all to fall into. I mean, who hasn't been centered on a boyfriend or a girlfriend at one point? Let's pretend that Brady centered his life on his girlfriend, Tasha. Now, watch the instability it creates in Brady. Here's Tasha's action. She makes a rude comment. Here's how Brady reacts. Oh, my day is ruined. Here's Tasha again. She flirts with Brady's best friend. And Brady's reactions? I've been betrayed. I hate my friend. Here's Tasha again. I think we should date other people. Here's Brady's reaction. My life is over. You don't love me anymore. The ironic thing is that the more you center your life on someone, the more unattractive you become to that person. How's that? Well, first of all, if you're centered on someone, you're no longer hard to get. Second, it's irritating when someone builds their entire emotional life around you. Since their security comes from you and not from within themselves, they always need to have those sickening, where do we stand talks. When I began dating my wife, one of the things that attracted me most was that she didn't center her life on me. I'll never forget the time she turned me down with a smile and no apology for a very important date. I loved it. She was her own person and had her own inner strength. Her moods were independent of mine. You can usually tell when a couple becomes centered on each other because they are forever breaking up and then getting back together again. Although the relationship has deteriorated, their emotional lives and identities are so intertwined that they can never fully let go of each other. Believe me, you'll be a much better boyfriend or girlfriend if you're not centered on your partner. Independence is more attractive than dependence. Besides, centering your life on another person doesn't show that you love them, only that you're dependent on them. Have as many girlfriends or boyfriends as you'd like, just don't get obsessed with or centered on them. Because although there are exceptions, these relationships are usually about as stable as a yo-yo. School-centered. Among teens, centering one's life on school is more common than you might think. Lisa from Canada regrets being school-centered for such a long time.
I've been so ambitious and so school-centered that I haven't enjoyed my youth. It has not only been unhealthy for myself, but it's been selfish, because all I cared about was me and my achievements. As a seventh grader, I was already working as hard as a college student. I wanted to be a brain surgeon, just because it was the hardest thing I could think of. I would get up at 6 every morning all through school and not go to bed before 2 a.m. in order to achieve. I felt teachers and peers expected it of me. They would always be surprised if I didn't get perfect grades. My parents tried to loosen me up, but my own expectations were as great as that of teachers and peers. I realize now that I could have accomplished what I wanted without trying so hard, and I could have had a good time doing it.
Now, our education obviously is vital to our futures and should be a top priority, but we must be careful not to let dean's lists and GPAs and AP classes take over our lives. School-centered teens often become so obsessed with getting good grades that they often forget that the real purpose of school is to learn. As thousands of teens have proved, you can do extremely well in school and still maintain a healthy balance in your life. Thank goodness our worth isn't measured by our GPA. Parent-centered. Your parents can be your greatest source of love and guidance, and you should respect and honor them. But centering your life on your parents and living to please them above everything else can become a real nightmare. Don't tell your parents I said that or they might take away your book. Just kidding. Read what happened to this young girl from Louisiana.
I worked so hard all semester. I just knew that my parents would be pleased, 6 A's and 1 B+. But all I could see in their eyes was disappointment. All they wanted to know was why the B+ wasn't an A. It was all I could do not to cry. What did they want from me? That was my sophomore year of high school, and I spent the next 2 years trying to make my parents proud of me. I played basketball, and I hoped that they would be proud. They never came to see me play. I made the honor roll every semester, but after a while, straight A's were just expected. I was going to go to college to be a teacher, but there was no money in that, and my parents felt that I would be better off studying something else, so I did. Every decision I made was prefaced with the questions. What would Mom and Dad want me to do? Would they be proud? Would they love me? But no matter what I did, it was never good enough. I had based my whole life on the goals and aspirations my parents thought were good, and it didn't make me happy. I had lived to please my parents for so long that I felt out of control. I felt worthless, useless, and unimportant. Eventually, I realized that my parents' approval wasn't coming, and if I didn't get my act together, I would destroy myself. I needed to find a center that was timeless, unchanging, and real, a center that couldn't shout, disapprove, or criticize. So I started to live my own life by the principles that I thought would bring me happiness, like honesty with myself and parents, faith in a happier life, hope for the future, and belief in my own goodness. In the beginning, I sort of had to pretend that I was strong, but over a period of time, I became strong. Finally, I shook out on my own and had a falling out with my folks, but it made them see who I was, and they loved me. They apologized for all the pressure they put on me and expressed their love. I was 18 years old before I ever remember my dad saying, "I love you," but they were still the sweetest words I have ever heard, and well worth the wait. I still care about what my parents think, and I am still influenced by their opinions, but ultimately, I have become responsible for my life and my actions. I try to please myself before anybody else.
Other possible centers. The list of possible centers could go on and on. Sports or hobby-centered people? That's a big one. How many times have we seen a sports-centered jock build his identity around being a great athlete, only to suffer a career-ending injury? It happens all the time. And the poor guy is left to rebuild his life from scratch. The same goes for hobbies and interests such as dance, debate, drama, music, or clubs. And what about being hero-centered? If you build your life around a movie or a rock star, a famous athlete, or a powerful politician, what happens if they die, if they do something really stupid, or end up in jail? Where are you then? Sometimes we can even become enemy-centered and build our entire emotional life around hating somebody, hating a group, hating a person, hating an idea, like Captain Hook, whose entire existence revolved around hating Peter Pan. This is often the case with gangs and with bitter divorces. What a warped center this one is. Becoming work-centered is a sickness that usually afflicts older people, but can also reach teens. Workaholism is usually driven by a compulsive need to have more stuff, like money, cars, status, or recognition, which feeds us for a season, but never fully satisfies. Another common center is being self-centered, or thinking the world revolves around you and your problems. This often results in being so worried about your own condition that you're oblivious to the walking wounded all around you. As you can see, all these and many more life centers do not provide the stability that you and I need in life. I'm not saying we shouldn't strive to become excellent in something like dance or debate, or strive to develop outstanding relationships with our friends and parents. We should. But there's a fine line between having a passion for something and basing your entire existence on it. And that's the line we shouldn't cross. Principle-centered, the real thing. In case you were starting to wonder, there is a center that actually works. What is it? Let's hear the drum roll. It's being principle-centered. We are all familiar with the effects of gravity. Throw a ball up and it comes down. It's a natural law or principle. Just as there are principles that rule the physical world, there are principles that rule the human world. Principles, they're not religious, they aren't American or Chinese, they aren't mine, they're not yours, they aren't up for discussion, they apply equally to everyone, rich or poor, king or peasant, male or female, they can't be bought, they can't be sold. If you live by them, you will excel. If you break them, you will fail. Hey, that sort of rhymes. It's that simple. Here are a few examples of principles. Honesty is a principle. Service is a principle. Love is a principle. Hard work is a principle. Respect, gratitude, moderation, fairness, integrity, loyalty, responsibility. All of these are principles. There are dozens and dozens more. They are not hard to identify. Just as a compass always points to true north, your heart will always recognize true principles. For example, think about the principle of hard work. If you haven't paid the price, you may be able to get by for a while, but eventually it'll catch up to you. I remember one time being invited to play in a golf tournament with my college football coach. He was a great golfer. Everyone, including my coach, expected that I'd be a fine golfer as well. After all, I was a college athlete, and all college athletes should be great golfers, right? Wrong. You see, I stunk at golf. I'd only played a few times in my life, and I didn't even know how to hold a club properly. I was kind of nervous about everyone finding out how bad I was at golf, especially my coach. So I was kind of hoping that I could fool him and everyone else into thinking I was pretty good. On the very first hole, there was a small crowd gathered around. I was first up to tee off. Why me? As I stepped up to hit the ball, I prayed for a miracle. I swung. Swoosh! It worked. A miracle. I couldn't believe it. I had hit a long shot straight down the middle of the fairway. Woo! I turned around and smiled to the crowd and acted as if I had always hit like that. Thank you. Thank you very much. I had them all fooled. But I was only fooling myself because, you see, there were 17 and a half more holes to go. In fact, it took only about 5 more shots for everyone around me, including my coach, to realize that I was a complete golf nerd. It wasn't long until the coach was trying to show me how to swing the club. I'd been exposed. Ouch! Now, you can't fake playing golf, tuning a guitar, or speaking Arabic if you haven't paid the price to get good. There's no shortcut. Hard work is a principle. As the NBA great Larry Bird once put it, if you don't do your homework, you won't make your free throws. Principles never fail. It takes faith to live by principles, especially when you see other people close to you get ahead in life by lying and cheating and indulging and manipulating and serving only themselves. What you don't see, however, is that breaking principles always catches up to them in the end. Take the principle of honesty. If you're a big liar, you may be able to get by for a while, even for a few years. But you'd be hard-pressed to find a liar who achieves success over the long haul. As Cecil B. DeMille observed about his classic movie, The Ten Commandments, it is impossible for us to break the law. We can only break ourselves against the law. Unlike all the other sinners we've looked at, principles will never fail you. They won't talk behind your back. They don't get up and move. They don't suffer career-ending injuries. They don't play favorites based on skin color, gender, wealth, or body features. A principle-centered life is simply the most stable, immovable, and shakable foundation you can build upon, and we all need one of those. To grasp why principles always work, just imagine living a life based on their opposites. A life of dishonesty, loafing, indulgence, ingratitude, and selfishness, and hate. I can't imagine any good thing coming out of that, can you? Ironically, putting principles first is the key to doing better in all of the other centers. For example, if you live the principle of service, respect, and love, you're likely to pick up more friends and be a more stable boyfriend or girlfriend. Putting principles first is also the key to becoming a person of character. Decide today to make principles your life center or paradigm. In whatever situation you find yourself, ask, what is the principle in play here? For every problem, search for the principle that will solve it. If you're feeling worn out and beaten up by life, perhaps you should try the principle of balance. If you find no one trusts you, the principle of honesty might just be the cure you need. In the following story by Walter McPeak, loyalty was the principle in play.
One of two brothers fighting in the same company in France fell by a German bullet. The one who escaped asked permission of his officer to go and bring his brother in. He is probably dead, said the officer, and there's no use in you risking your life to bring in his body. But after further pleading, the officer consented. Just as the soldier reached the lines with his brother on his shoulders, the wounded man died. There you see, said the officer, you risked your life for nothing. No, replied Tom, I did what he expected of me, and I have my reward. When I crept up to him and took him in my arms, he said, Tom, I knew you would come. I just felt you would come.
In the upcoming chapters, you'll discover that each of the seven habits is based upon a basic principle or two, and that's where they get their power from. The long and short of it is, principles rule. Coming attractions. Up next, we'll talk about how to get rich in a way you probably never thought of. So, carry on. A word about baby steps. One of my family's favorite movies of all time is What About Bob, starring Bill Murray and Richard Dreyfuss. It's the story of a dysfunctional, phobia-laden, immature, pea-brained leech named Bob who never, ever goes away. He attaches himself to Dr. Marvin, a renowned psychiatrist who wants nothing more than to get rid of Bob and finally gives him a book he wrote called Baby Steps. He tells Bob that the best way to solve his problems is not to bite off too much at once, but to just take baby steps to reach his goals. Bob is delighted. He no longer has to worry about how to get all the way home from Dr. Marvin's office, a big task for Bob. Instead, Bob only has to baby step his way out of the office, and then baby step his way onto the elevator, and so on. So, I'll give you some baby steps at the end of each chapter, starting with this one. Small, easy steps that you can do immediately to help you apply what you just learned. Though small, these steps can become powerful tools in helping you achieve your larger goals. So, come along with me and Bob. He really becomes very likable after you accept the fact that you can't shake him and take some baby steps.
Baby steps number one. The next time you look in the mirror, say something positive about yourself.
Number two. Show appreciation for someone's point of view today. Say something like, hey, that's a cool idea.
Number three. Think of a limiting paradigm you might have of yourself, such as, I'm not outgoing. Now do something today that totally contradicts that paradigm.
Number four. Think of a loved one or close friend who has been acting out of character lately. Consider what might be causing them to act that way.
Number five. When you have nothing to do, what is it that occupies your thoughts? Remember, whatever is most important to you will become your paradigm or life center.
Number six. The golden rule rules. Begin a day to treat others as you would want them to treat you. Don't be impatient, complain about leftovers, or badmouth someone, unless you want the same treatment.
Number seven. Sometime soon, find a quiet place where you can be alone. Think about what matters most to you.
Number eight. Listen carefully to the lyrics of the music you listen to most frequently. Evaluate if they are in harmony with the principles you believe in.
Number nine. When you do your chores at home or work tonight, try out the principle of hard work. Go the extra mile and do more than is expected.
Number 10. The next time you're in a tough situation and don't know what to do, ask yourself, what principles should I apply? Honesty, love, loyalty, hard work, patience. Now follow the principle and don't look back.
Part 2. The private victory. The personal bank account. Starting with the man in the mirror. Habit 1. Be proactive. I am the force. Habit 2. Begin with the end in mind. Control your own destiny or someone else will. Habit 3. Put first things first. Will and won't power. The personal bank account, starting with a man in the mirror. Before you'll ever win in the public arenas of life, you must first win private battles within yourself. All change begins with you. I'll never forget how I learned this lesson. What's wrong with you? You're disappointing me. Where's the Sean I once knew in high school? Coach glared at me. Do you even want to be out there? I was shocked. I said, yes, of course. Oh, come on, give me a break. You're just going through the motions and your heart's not in it. I'm telling you something, you better get your act together or the younger quarterbacks will pass you up and you'll never play here. It was my sophomore year at Brigham Young University, BYU, during preseason football camp. Coming out of high school, I was recruited by many colleges but chose BYU because they had a tradition of producing All-American quarterbacks like Jim McMahon and Steve Young, both of whom went on to the pros and led their teams to Super Bowl victories. Although I was the third-string quarterback at the time, I wanted to be the next All-American. When Coach told me that I was stinking up the field, it came as a cold, hard slap in the face. The thing that really bugged me was he was right. Even though I was spending long hours practicing, I wasn't truly committed. I was holding back, and I knew it. I had a hard decision to make. I had to either quit football or triple my commitment. So over the next several weeks, I waged a war inside my head and came face to face with many fears and self-doubts. Did I have what it took to be the starting quarterback? Could I handle the pressure? Was I big enough? It soon became clear to me that I was scared. I was scared of competing, scared of being in the limelight, scared of trying and perhaps failing, and all of these fears were holding me back from giving it my all. I read a great quote by Arnold Bennett that describes what I finally decided to do about my dilemma. He wrote, "The real tragedy is the tragedy of the man who never in his life braces himself for his one supreme effort. He never stretches to his full capacity, never stands up to his full stature." Having never enjoyed tragedy myself, I decided to brace myself for one supreme effort. So I committed to give it my all. I decided to stop holding back and to lay it all on the line. I didn't know if I would ever get a chance to be first string, but if I didn't, at least I was going to strike out swinging. No one heard me say, "I commit." There was no applause. It was simply a private battle I fought and won inside my own mind over a period of several weeks. Once I committed myself, everything changed. I began taking chances and making big improvements on the field. My heart was in it, and the coaches took notice. As the season began and the games rolled by one, I sat on the bench. Although frustrated, I kept working hard and kept improving. Mid-season featured the big game of the year. We were to play nationally ranked Air Force on ESPN in front of 65,000 fans. A week before the game, Coach called me into his office and told me that I would be the starting quarterback. Gulp. Needless to say, that was the longest week of my life. Game day finally arrived. At kickoff, my mouth was so dry I could barely talk. But after a few minutes, I settled down and led our team to victory. I was even named the ESPN player of the game. Afterward, lots of people congratulated me on the victory and my performance. That was nice, but they didn't really understand. They didn't know the real story. They thought that victory had taken place on the field that day in the public eye. I knew it happened months before in the privacy of my own head, when I decided to face my fears, to stop holding back, and to brace myself for one supreme effort. Beating Air Force was a much easier challenge than overcoming myself. Private victories always come before public victories. As the saying goes, we have met the enemy, and he is us. Inside out. We crawl before we walk. We learn arithmetic before algebra. We must fix ourselves before we can fix others. If you want to make a change in your life, The place to begin is with yourself, not with your parents or your boyfriend or your professor. All change begins with you. It's inside out, not outside in. I am reminded of the writings of an Anglican bishop. When I was young and free and my imagination had no limits, I dreamed of changing the world. As I grew older and wiser, I realized the world would not change. And I decided to shorten my sight somewhat and change only my country. But it, too, seemed immovable. As I entered my twilight years, in one last desperate attempt, I sought to change only my family, those closest to me. But alas, they would have none of it. And now, here I lie on my deathbed and realize, perhaps for the first time, that if only I'd changed myself first, then by example I may have influenced my family, and with their encouragement and support, I may have bettered my country, and who knows, I may have changed the world. This is what this book is all about, changing from the inside out, starting with the man or the woman in the mirror. This chapter, The Personal Bank Account, and the ones that follow on Habits 1, 2, and 3 deal with you and your character, or the private victory. The next four chapters, The Relationship Bank Account and Habits 4, 5, and 6, deal with relationships, or the public victory. Before diving into Habit 1, let's take a look at how you can immediately begin to build your self-confidence and achieve a private victory. How you feel about yourself is like a bank account. Let's call it your personal bank account, or PBA. Just like a checking or a savings account at a bank, you can make deposits into and take withdrawals from your PBA by the things you think, say, and do. For example, when I stick to a commitment I've made to myself, I feel in control. It's a deposit. Cha-ching! On the other hand, when I break a promise to myself, I feel disappointed and make a withdrawal. So, let me ask you, how is your PBA? How much trust and confidence do you have in yourself? Are you loaded or bankrupt? The symptoms listed below might help you evaluate where you stand. Possible symptoms of a poor PBA. You cave into peer pressure easily. You wrestle with feelings of depression and inferiority. You're overly concerned about what others think of you. You act arrogant to help you hide your insecurities. You self-destruct by getting heavily into drugs, pornography, vandalism, or gangs. You get jealous easily, especially when someone close to you succeeds. Here are some possible symptoms of a healthy PBA. You stand up for yourself and resist peer pressure. You're not overly concerned about being popular. You see life as a generally positive experience. You trust yourself. You are goal-driven. You are happy for the successes of other people. If your personal bank account is low, don't get discouraged about it. Just start today by making $1, $5, $10, or $25 deposits. Eventually, you'll get your confidence back. Small deposits over a long period of time is a way to a healthy and rich PBA. With the help of various teen groups, I've compiled a list of 6 key deposits that can help you build your PBA. Of course, with every deposit, there is an equal and opposite withdrawal. Deposit? Keep promises to yourself. The opposite withdrawal? Break personal promises. Deposit. Do small acts of kindness. Withdrawal? Keep to yourself. Deposit. Be gentle with yourself. Withdrawal? Beat yourself up. Deposit. Be honest. Withdrawal? Be dishonest. Deposit. Renew yourself. The withdrawal? Wear yourself out. And the last one, the deposit, tap into your talents. The withdrawal, neglect your talents. Keep promises to yourself. Have you ever had friends or roommates who seldom come through? They say they'll call you and they don't. They promise to pick you up for the game and they forget. After a while, you don't trust them. Their commitments mean nothing. The same thing occurs when you continually make and break self-promises, such as, I'm going to get up at 6 tomorrow morning, or I'm going to get my homework done tonight when I get home. After a while, you don't trust yourself. We should treat the commitments we make to ourselves as seriously as those we make to the most important people in our lives. If you're feeling out of control in life, focus on the single thing you can control, yourself. Make a promise to yourself and keep it. Start with real small $10 commitments that you know you can complete, like committing to eat healthier today. After you've built up some self-trust, you can then go for the more difficult $100 deposits, such as deciding to break up with an abusive boyfriend or not going after your sister for wearing your new clothes. Do small acts of kindness. I remember reading a statement by a psychiatrist who said that if you ever feel depressed, the best thing to do is to do something for someone else. Why? Because it gets you focused outward, not inward. It's hard to be depressed while serving somebody else. Ironically, a byproduct of helping others is feeling wonderful yourself. I remember sitting in an airport one day waiting for my flight. I was excited because I had been upgraded to a first-class ticket. And in first class, the seats are bigger, the food is edible, and the flight attendants are actually nice. In fact, I had the best seat on the entire plane, seat 1A. Before boarding, I noticed a young lady who had several carry-on bags and was holding a crying baby. Having just finished reading a book on doing random acts of kindness, I heard my conscience speak to me. You scumbag, let her have your ticket. I fought these promptings for a while, but eventually caved in. Pardon me, but you look like you could use this first-class ticket more than me with that kid and all. I know how hard it can be flying with kids. Why don't you let me trade you tickets? Are you sure? Oh, yeah, really, I don't mind. I'm just going to be working the whole time anyway. Well, thank you. That's very kind of you, she said as we swapped tickets. As we boarded the plane, I was surprised at how good it made me feel to watch her sit down in seat 1A. In fact, under the circumstances, seat 24B or wherever the heck I was sitting didn't seem that bad at all. At one point during the flight, I was so curious to see how she was doing that I could hardly stand it. So I got up out of my seat, walked to the first class section, and peeked in through the curtain that separates first class from coach. There she was with her baby, both asleep in big and comfortable seat 1A, and I felt like $1 million. Cha-ching! I've got to keep doing this kind of thing. This sweet story shared by a teen named Tawny is another example of the joy of service.
There is a girl in our neighborhood who lives in a duplex with her parents, and they don't have a lot of money. For the past 3 years, when I grew out of my clothes, me and my mom took them over to her. I say something like, I thought you might like these, or I like to see you wearing this. When she wore something I gave her, I think it was really cool. She would say, thank you so much for the new shirt. I reply, that color looks really good on you.